From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today, we're broadcasting our show from WCLK in Atlanta, Georgia. We'll be in the city all week, taking you behind the scenes of the music industry, discussing the challenges of the latest drought, and exploring hip-hop's relationship with politics. Atlanta hosted the Summer Olympics in 1996, which put the city in the international spotlight. Today, the city continues to attract new people, businesses, and culture. The woman who tackles the city's toughest issues on a daily basis is Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin. She's the first black woman ever to lead a major southern city. And a few years ago, Time magazine called her one of America's five best big city mayors. Mayor Franklin, it's a delight to meet you.
Well, welcome to Atlanta.
Yeah. There's so much going on with your city, and you have about 20 months left to accomplish quite a lot. You have accomplished so much already, but right now with your city facing a $65 million shortfall, are you daunted by that?
Well, big numbers like tens of millions of dollars are always daunting, but Atlanta is one of those cities that it's a can-do city. We band together to do what others might think is impossible. We know how to attack budget problems. Because we've learned so much about our own operation, but also best practices around the country.
How do you think the spirit of Atlantans is now? And I mean that in the sense of our nation going through some very challenging times, 81% of Americans feeling as if the country is not headed in the right direction.
Well, Atlanta is an optimistic city, but we are all concerned. I mean, I know that from my discussions with civic leaders and community people, as well as business leaders, we are concerned about the economy. People are concerned about their ability to predict how well they will be doing at home a year from now, and whether they will be able to support their children going to college, or to buy that new home, or to keep that new home. So there is a certain amount of anxiety about the economy and the recession. But I think at the same time, Atlanta is hopeful that this region and Atlanta as the center of the Southeast region will come out of the recession soon and successfully. So I think overall people are hopeful, but they are watching their pocketbooks very closely.
When Atlanta is going through a period of severe drought, you have stepped up and made environmental issues a key part of your platform. But, you know, theoretically, at least, there are no rainmakers. There are no people who can call down water from the sky. You can only do so much. What are you planning to do that involves mitigating the effects of the drought and then long-term planning for the city?
Well, it's interesting that you raise the drought, because water and sewer was on, and water issues were on my agenda from 2002 as a result of a series of lawsuits in federal court, and the city had agreed to make certain improvements in its sewer system. In my administration decided that we would take on the drinking water issues as well. And the drought has most to do with drinking water, although all of these water systems are interrelated. So we added to our capital program $1 billion, which we are in the process of spending now to upgrade our water system. That means fixing the leaks, repairing the water lines, replacing water lines that have been in the ground in downtown and midtown Atlanta for over 100 years and that were leaking very badly. So we are finding that our investment came just in the nick of time as the drought started about 17 to 18 months ago. One of my favorite examples, though, of what we've done, the city owns and operates the Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, and we have 1,000 toilets at the airport. And we changed the flush on those toilets from 3 gallons to 1 gallon. That is a huge change.
Let's talk about the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities that pump billions of dollars into the economy of Atlanta. They have been such a great asset, not just to the city, but to the nation as a whole. When you talk about the number of black professionals and doctors that have come out of these universities, but some of them are struggling financially and academically. How does the city affect the future of the HBCUs?
The HBCUs, in a city like Atlanta are a part of the foundation of why we've been successful. One of our mayors, Maynard Jackson, was a graduate of Morehouse College. Andrew Young and I are both graduates of Howard University. We have many professionals and other elected officials who are graduates of HBCUs in Atlanta and HBCUs across the country. So Atlanta needs to be ever more cognizant of the role that they've played in our success. There are many things that we can do that we haven't done yet, but the one that I'm most proud of is actually helping young people attend Clark Atlanta University, attend Morehouse College, attend Spelman College, because of the advocacy that we provide and also the financial support.
This is a personal question, and I'm sure it won't be pleasant, but your daughter was put on probation for dealing with some financial issues related to her husband, who was up on drug charges and convicted. It strikes me that all of us have issues in our family, that there's no family that is untouched by troubles, including legal troubles. How do you deal on a personal level and also on a structural level in your position with the issue of drugs?
I abhor drugs. Make it clear to anyone. I've never been a drug user. There are many people who are now explaining that they used drugs in their youth. I've made mistakes. I don't want to make sound like I'm Miss Goody Two-Shoes. But the bottom line is drugs, illegal drugs, ruin our community. But on the issue of my daughter, it's very interesting. When you run for public life, you fully expect your own life to be evaluated. I did not expect that my children's lives would make the front page or NPR. And I'm not sure I would have run if I had known that. It is, I think, unfair to have the kind of coverage of someone's, a child's personal life, especially an adult child. And I think this has been overplayed in the media. People can feed on other people's hard times, or they can take sustenance from their success. So I think to a large extent, the fact that you even know about my daughter is a miscarriage of the media.
Do you think that some people are actually too daunted by the challenge of dealing with the media to go into public life? Because if you go into private office as an executive, you don't have to face that scrutiny.
Well, the truth of the matter is I won't run again for that reason. I will not put my children, my grandchildren, or any of my family members in the spotlight again in elective office. The public can decide whether that's good or bad. It's great for me.
What about on a level of being a mayor? How do you deal with drugs?
How do I deal with them? We have a very aggressive a drug enforcement program. We are a part of a task force. We work with the U.S. attorney. We work with drug and enforcement agency. Our agency, which is the police department, works very, very, very aggressively on a regional level and with the federal government. And we will continue to do that. Drugs and guns are huge factors in violent crime in any city, and the same is true in Atlanta. We also a center of foreclosures and fraudulent lending practices. There are many areas on which we have to, both civil and criminal, that any mayor has to take on.
Speaking of foreclosures, the country has been rocked, the financial markets have been rocked by it, and there have been clear signs in the studies that have come out of it that African Americans in particular have been targeted. Even people with good credit have been targeted for subprime loans and for exploitative loans. How do you help people who are in that position of potentially losing their homes?
Well, we advocate. That's a great question. We advocate at the state level for tougher laws on fraudulent lending practices. Unfortunately, in Georgia, we have loosened our enforcement and requirements, and we have to be vigilant on that. And we hope that in partnership with some members of the business community and good lenders, I mean solid lenders, fair people, that we will be able to change the laws so that it is harder for bad practices, lending practices, to be so rampant in the city of Atlanta and the state of Georgia.
This is an extraordinary time in politics where you have a white man, a white woman, and a black man all in contention for the presidency. What do you think that's done, if anything, to the aspirations of younger people?
Well, you put it a way that I wouldn't put it. I would say we have a war hero in a time when we are not celebrating war. We have a person from a mixed background, African and white American, and we have a former first lady. So that's another way to look at these three. So it's a remarkable time, as you've implied, that it gives us an opportunity to say to young people, the door is open for you to take your rightful place and to be politically engaged or engaged in business. I think it's a very exciting time, and everyone should be taking notes. You know, Eleanor Roosevelt wasn't able to run for president, but she was a dynamic first lady. And so Hillary Clinton is a new era first lady in many ways. Obviously, Barack Obama, in part because he's African American, but also because he is a much younger man, and he's also coming from a perspective where we are, his background marries our global connections. And then finally, I grew up in the era of Eisenhower, a great war hero. And indeed, here we are at a time when most Americans are opposed to the war in Iraq, actually celebrating the leadership of a war hero in his candidacy. So I think there are many levels of discourse and discussion. And young people, I know they're paying attention. We can see that at the polls. We can see it on the college campuses. We can see it in young people even as young as elementary level. It's a good time to be alive.
Mayor Franklin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Shirley Franklin is the mayor of Atlanta, Georgia. You can learn more about Franklin's career and watch part of our interview at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Welcome to Hotlanta, a city where plenty of black folks own their own businesses, where historically black colleges and universities are pumping out black professionals and intellectuals, and where entertainment has found a new home without the high cost of Hollywood or Manhattan. So how did this southern city become a mecca for black movers and shakers? Monica Pearson and William Boone have plenty of experience in watching Atlanta grow. Monica is an Action News nightly anchor for the local Atlanta station, WSB-TV, and Professor Boone is an associate professor of political science at Clark Atlanta University. Monica and Professor Boone, welcome.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks.
So let's start with the mayor. We just heard from her, and Monica, I'm sure that you've covered her many times. As her tenure goes into its final year and a half, how do you think that she will be perceived as a mayor?
I think she will be perceived as one of the greatest mayors we've had because she was willing to deal with topics no one wanted to deal with before. No one wanted to bite the bullet and clean up the city's infrastructure in terms of the horrible things we had going on with our water and sewer system. She was willing to say, we are going to raise the taxes, we are going to raise the rates, and we are going to fix the problems.
Professor, considering that there's now a budget shortfall, does that change the equation at all for how Atlanta's health is going to unfold over the next couple years?
I don't think so. I think a good deal of that has to do, of course, with the national economy. That's why the city is going down. Well, the city's not going downhill. Why you find the shortfalls? And, of course, you understand that the city cannot be in default, period. So it has to have a balanced budget, so cuts are going to be made. And I think, as Monica indicated, Mayor Franklin's position with the community is so high. Her rating is so high. I think that what she talks about, folk understand it. They believe her, and that's very, very important.
And she's willing to take the heat.
Right.
She's not afraid to say, I know this is painful, but sometimes you have to have a little pain in order to make it better. There had been many mayors before her who saw the problems with the city's infrastructure and did nothing about it. She came in saying, we're going to fix the potholes, but more importantly, we're going to clean up the water. We're going to do the things that the federal government is mandating.
Well, Professor, I want to ask you and Monica afterwards about your relationship with this city. I understand you're not a native, but you have been here for quite a while. Tell us about how you got to Atlanta.
Actually, I first arrived in Atlanta to attend Atlanta University, and I picked up a couple of degrees, went to the West, went to Texas, as a matter of fact, and had to come back. And the first time someone offered me a chance to return to Atlanta, I returned. As a matter of fact, my wife pushed me back to make sure. Atlanta is a very dynamic city. It's a very dynamic city. And in my profession, political science, it offers a great opportunity because here we are in the South. And the South is where all the political action takes place. And that's something other folks don't want to recognize. And Atlanta is the center of the of that firestorm of activity.
Monica, what about you? Are you a native? Or
I've been here 33 years. I came from Louisville, Kentucky, and I came for a job when they were going to put a woman on the 6 o'clock news, and they got a twofer, an African-American and a woman. Until I came 33 years ago, there were no women or African-Americans doing the nightly news. We did noon, we did weekends, but the bread and butter shows, there were no women or African-Americans on. So I came for that. But I came also because of the AU complex, where you had the center of activity in academia. It was exciting, and you could see how the city was growing and how it was, even then, 33 years ago, beginning to be international.
And actually, right, because you know, this is the home of Du Bois. And Du Bois started here, and a good many exciting things have happened in the city around the center. And the black community has always been aggressive about its position in the city. I mean, certainly there are those who may characterize it differently. But overall, I think you have to characterize it as one that's been concerned and one that's been a vital part of pushing the city forward.
And you've got to remember, too, and I'm sure you would agree with me, Dr. Boone, everyone knows Madam C.J. Walker.
Yes.
But how many people know Dr. Alonzo Herndon, who was the first millionaire, black millionaire, right, with a barbershop down on a white street?
Right.
So, actually, Professor, I want you to take us a little further back in history to the days of the, you know, antebellum, Civil War, Reconstruction. What was the place of African Americans in the city that far back?
Oh, it was what you would expect. I mean, because coming out of the American Civil War, all of the South was devastated economically, politically, and socially. And Atlanta was no different. I mean, after all, Sherman had marched through Atlanta, had rent the psyche of most of these people, and they were so anti-North, which of course translated to being anti-black. And blacks were, but although blacks were here, and the black population, they began to pull itself together, and it did begin to move, because it was in Atlanta and surrounding areas that you got to push for education. I think that's very important. So you did have that kind of progressive strand in the black community in Atlanta. Then the response to the white community, of course, was not what one would expect. But certainly it came around probably when Henry Grady arrived on the scene.
And you have to remember also, too, that when Sherman came through and burned us down, it was because the city was a major distribution center for the Confederate Army, which, although it's not for the Confederate Army anymore, it is still a major distribution center. Atlanta has always been talking about trade, talking about transportation, because it started out as Terminus, which was where the train stopped.
Yeah, right. And that's very important because Atlanta started as a city that wanted to be a part of the northern business elite and northern business progressivism, although you had some people want to hold back. But it's always been that way, and it's continued. That has been the hallmark of Atlanta. And if black folk brought pressure on the business elite in order to get certain concessions and to make the city too busy to hate.
Now, you've got to remember, too, Auburn Avenue, which let us not forget that even with the segregation, there was always a very strong black economic community here on Auburn Avenue.
Yeah, very vibrant.
Let's touch briefly on the civil rights era. Of course, the city has a long history of being, as you mentioned, Professor, a political center. What do you think that Atlanta brought to the movement?
Well, Martin Luther King. But beyond that, Atlanta, it was very interesting because Atlanta acted as a more of a moderating force if one looks at the history of it. Because up for a long period of time, there were no major demonstrations in Atlanta. There finally was one, and it was somewhat moderated by the white business elite. And when I say moderate, I don't mean they capitulated. I simply mean that they were prepared not to allow the Klan and other elements to come in and give the city a black eye, which gave the black community some leverage in terms of trying to move things forward on that particular scale.
Because even before Dr. King, his daddy, Martin Luther King Sr., what he would do, he and a large number of African Americans would meet with the white business leaders and would work things out.
Yeah, they would. And I think there's a lot of research on that, which indicated that they did more consulting than anything else because those particular individuals, although very aggressive and very prominent individuals, sometimes only have to bring back what the white community wanted. But you also saw within the black community during that period, in that post-civil rights period of the 60s, the unity among black Democrats and black Republicans. They threw aside the party labels and began to move in a way that is shown in the days of unity. That gives us a Maynard Jackson and the black mayors that have succeeded him.
And when you look at what also happened after the death of Dr. King, the assassination of Dr. King, you have to look at the white mayor at that time, Ivan Allen, who said, got with the black community. And we had no riots in Atlanta during that period because of the work of both the black and the white community. But even before that, when Dr. King won the Nobel Peace Prize, there had never been an integrated dinner in this city. And Ivan Allen said, how can we not honor the sun? And he then got the American Hotel to have the first integrated dinner in the city for Dr. King.
Now, Monica, considering that you've been here 33 years, you must have seen the metro area grow phenomenally. And one of the things we're going to talk about shortly is the immigrant population, how there's so many more African and Caribbean immigrants. What else have you seen happen?
Well, not only African and Caribbean, but we also have a huge influx of people from Latin America. And it's amazing how the city also has grown in its diversity in terms of food. Buford Highway is a stretch of where you can go from like a Lenox Square all white to the next phase. You're moving into the Latin community, and then the next phase, you're into the Chinese and Japanese communities. We have Saturday schools here for the Japanese, for German children. The city is no longer just black or white.
Professor, let me move us a little bit into the economy. Now, obviously, there's some companies that have been headquartered here, Coca-Cola, Home Depot, UPS, and on and on and on. But this merger between, Delta going in and really absolutely bonding with Northwest, I mean, pending approval, is that going to help the city, you think?
We were talking about this beforehand.
Earlier, right? Yeah, certainly it's going to help the city of Atlanta because the hub of the newly merged airline will be here in the city. And certainly that cannot do anything but help Atlanta. And as you if you will recall, Delta started here, of course, and Atlanta and Delta are synonymous in a certain context. I don't know what it's going to do for customers and other folk like that, but in terms of the city's image and the city to be able to brand itself, yes, and to enlarge the airport, all that's to Atlanta's benefit.
And Monica, there have been quite a few companies that have come here, but we were talking about, you know, people are asking, why is it that Delta got it? Well, what people need to look at is that Northwestern is heavily unionized, while Delta is in a right-to-work state and is not that unionized except for the pilots' union.
Yeah, and which I think is problems down the road for the newly merged. We're going to talk about the politics of it. It's really problems for them, I think, in that regard. In terms of the union versus non-union and Atlanta. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, we have to wrap this up. It's so exciting, but I want to ask you to comment on something the mayor said. She said it's a good time to be alive. Just quickly, Monica and then Professor, is it a good time to be alive in Atlanta?
I think it's a good time to be alive in the United States of America. Any day above ground is a good day. But in Atlanta, yes, because you see our community growing in so many ways. You see political strength growing, and you see our young people in the AU complex grabbing a hold to that they can do and be anything.
Yeah, it really is a great time. It's a great time in America because what we see is the playing out of something that I think the King would look upon with favor, both here in the city and nationally.
Well, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
William Boone is an associate professor of political science at Clark Atlanta University, and Monica Pearson is the evening news anchor for WSB-TV, and they both join me here at the studios of WCLK in Atlanta. Like all cities, Atlanta is constantly evolving. Right now, immigration is changing the cultural and economic landscape of the ATL. But the new arrivals face challenges with everything from finding a job to learning English and understanding a new culture. Right outside our hotel, we met three men who came thousands of miles to make a life in this city, all of them taxi drivers awaiting fares. The taxi business is a hub for African and Caribbean immigrants in the city. Here's some of that story.
My name is Dawit Haile. I came from Eritrea, 1984.
What were the biggest challenges when you first moved here?
The city and how to communicate with the people.
How do you think things are now? Do you think that African immigrants and Caribbean immigrants and American-born people get along?
Yeah, we get along.
What about socializing? Do you ever social, like when you're off on the weekends, do you ever hang out with friends who were born in the States?
Yeah, I used to have a girlfriend from America.
What do you like most about Atlanta?
Atlanta is a good city. It's a clean, and most people, they are nice. And as long as you work, you live.
And when you think about the lives of Eritreans here,
yes.
Has it gotten easier, you think, for people who came after you because there's a more of a community?
Definitely. When they come here, they see somebody cousin or somebody friend, or they meet in a community or they meet in a church. So it's easier for them to learn the city, the language, and just to help them or just like that.
Okay, my name is Max Leger. I'm from Haiti.
How long have you been in Atlanta?
I got about 9 years. Atlanta is not like New York or Miami and others. Atlanta people are, there is more diversity. People are like, you know, all over. We have a lot of Haitian church. We got some, you know, places where Haitian hang out together. So when they get some parties, you know, we meet each other.
With the economic issues in Haiti right now, do you find a lot of people sending remittances back to Haiti?
Well, like, especially myself, I'm going to Haiti very often. My brother is in Haiti, actually. So we always keep, you know, in touch with family to see how we can help each other.
Now, what about your kids? How old are they? And they must be growing up to be very American in attitude. And is that good or bad to you?
My son is 13 years old. My daughter is, I got two daughters, one 11 and 7. So we are the one, we have to educate the kid, you know, give them, you know, parts of our culture. You know, it's not going to be 100%, but you have to talk to your kid to let them know where you're coming from, your background, your roots, you know.
Did you teach them to speak Creole?
Yeah, they do. They speak Creole. They speak French. I teach them French and Creole. So I believe it's very good when, you know, you speak more than one.
My name is Benga Babajide, and I come from Nigeria.
How long have you been here in Atlanta?
27 years.
Woo, so you have a commitment.
It's my home now.
Absolutely. Do you interact with a lot of other Nigerians or...
Well, we have a community center, and we also have a church-based environment that help any new ones to get used to American ways of life, as far as maybe getting a new job, you know, apply, you know, maybe starting getting new apartments and everything, just to blend in with American ways of life, which is, you know, pursuit of happiness.
Pursuit of happiness and pursuit of financial success, I assume.
I agree.
How do you get along with African Americans and other Atlantans? Do you find that you have to sometimes explain what life is like in Nigeria?
Well, I have no language barrier, so it was very easy for me. And also, even if I go in the community, I'm very well known within the Atlanta community as far as African Americans, and then they patronize us quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite thing about Atlanta?
Diversity. That's it. People come from all walks of life, and then they work together as a team.
We were speaking with Atlanta taxi drivers, Nigerian-American Benga Babajide, Haitian-American Max Leger, and Eritrean-American Dawit Haile. Welcome back to News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. For years, African Americans have flocked to Atlanta in search of economic and social opportunities. Now it's becoming a mecca for immigrants from all over the African diaspora. Thousands of people of Caribbean descent are trading in the hustle and bustle of northeastern cities like New York for the southern hospitality of Atlanta, while an increasing number of African immigrants are leaving their homelands and relocating to the southern city. So for immigrants, is Atlanta the shining city on the hill, or is it just another big American city with too many dreams and not enough opportunities? And how are African and Caribbean Americans mixing with native-born Americans? For more, we're joined by Misale Ayele, an immigration attorney. She's originally from Ethiopia, and Jason Walker, a journalist and community activist. He's a native of Jamaica. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very, very much. It's wonderful to be here. I've been a fan for so long.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for
now. Thank you, Misale. Now, over the past two decades, thousands of African and Caribbean immigrants have moved to Atlanta. Jason, the Caribbean population is growing rapidly. So what is it about Atlanta that makes it attractive?
Well, it's a combination of many factors. It started in the early 70s with some New Yorkers who had braved to travel to the South. And they basically told their friends. And the bottom line is this, what they were paying for rent with a little apartment, small apartment, they found they could pay for mortgage for a huge house and a huge huge land. But two really big factors really sparked everything. The carnival, which is now in its 20th year, the Atlanta Carnival, which is now it's actually the first carnival on the North American continent each year. So hundreds of thousands of Caribbean people come from all over the world for the carnival. And then they see this place. And for the New Yorkers, it's like, okay, New York is snow and all that. This is sunshine. A lot of Caribbean people who are in New York have been there for decades. So for them, this is like in between, close to home, so to speak, you know, weather-wise. And then, you know, it is the black mecca, upwardly mobile blacks and so on. It's like, you know, and not saying that Caribbean people are only blacks, but we're predominantly African. But, you know, we have many other races there. But that's besides the point.
Now, where are folks coming from? Because we just spoke with a Haitian-American. In terms of people coming from the Caribbean, where are folks coming from?
All over. Jamaica, Haiti, Guyana, Virgin Islands, and Trinidad, and Dominican Republic are probably the top ones out of the 35 Caribbean countries. But, you know, it's all over. You see, I didn't give you the second factor, which is the Olympics. The carnival and the Olympics really exposed Atlanta to everybody. And so once that happened, it was just a mass exodus. I mean, before 96, there are estimates of maybe 20,000 to 30,000 Caribbean people here. Well, now it's at 200,000 and growing rapidly.
That's in the metro area.
And that's in the greater metro area, mainly Stone Mountain, Lithonia, and Decatur.
Right.
Easily 80% of the Caribbean people are in that area.
Wow. Now, Misale, the African community in Atlanta is also diverse. We were speaking with people from East Africa, West Africa. And why don't you break it down for us, not just in terms of where people are from, but also, like all groups of immigrants, Africans come sometimes voluntarily in the sense of, you know, wanting to come to the U.S. and sometimes having to relocate as refugees. Does that make a difference in how people enter the life here?
Yes, I think it does. You know, there is a lot of people that relocate to Atlanta from the United States, and I think for those people, the factor that is positive is the cost of living being low and in the metropolitan area. But for the people, I think, that come as refugees or that are first comers into the United States and come to Atlanta or Georgia specifically, I think those people tend to come where they know somebody, whether it's a family member or a friend that can accommodate them until they adjust. So those two factors, I think, come into play for the newcomers into the area.
So we spoke to an Eritrean man, and what about the East African community, people from Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia? Is that a big community?
It is a very large community. Probably there are larger communities in other parts of the United States, like Washington, D.C. and California, but I think Atlanta has grown tremendously in the last decade, and you previously mentioned, the Olympics had a huge play in that, and that it highlighted the region, and a lot of people started migrating, at least from other parts of the United States, into Atlanta around.
Well, let's get into some of your personal stories. Jason, how did you enter this country? I mean, were you following someone else who was a relative?
Let me tell you something. This is what's crazy. I didn't even think about leaving Jamaica. Finished high school. You know, I was working a little bit. I did what we call sixth form, which is like in between high school and university. I was about to go to the University of the West Indies in Jamaica. I worked for a couple of years, so I was going to go there. And I wanted to do 2 degrees at the same time. Now, you didn't offer these 2 degrees at the same time for anybody. So I was like, well, I'm going to take my SATs and see what's going to happen. Did the SATs, got a good score. So all these universities are right to me. And I was like, well, I'm going to America. It was a last-minute decision. Now, I chose Atlanta because at the time, this was 91, 92. At the time, Atlanta wasn't known for a Caribbean population. See, I'm a DJ. I'm a DJ from Jamaica. I knew if I went to Florida, which is another second Caribbean, I would be distracted immediately. If I went to New York, there's no two ways about it. I would immediately be get involved in the entertainment scene and so on. So Atlanta, nothing was going on. Focus on my schoolwork. So that's actually why I came to Atlanta, to make sure I could do well in my studies. But all that didn't work because within a year, I had my own radio show.
You were DJing again.
head of a Caribbean organization. I was involved in everything. I guess that's part of my nature.
Ms. Ale, how did you enter life in Atlanta? Did you come from someplace else in the U.S., or how did that all work?
Well, initially I came in the early 80s when I came to the United States. I was going to a boarding school in Kentucky, but I had family in Atlanta, so I would come vacation here. And then as I finished high school, I went to Georgia State undergrad and then law school at Georgia State. Then I left Atlanta and moved to California, where a lot of immigrants were at the time, and I was doing immigration law. And I came back again 3 years ago to Atlanta, and I'm settled here now. And I think I'm part of the story of basically trying to find an area in the United States where you could have a fair cost of living so you can live the lifestyle that you want, especially having kids and wanting to spend time with them and not work as much. So I think I came for a different reason this time.
What about the whole issue of immigration law? It's a time when there are people who can wait a couple of years for citizenship, you know, because there's a backlog in terms of processing. There are questions about sanctuary cities and people who don't have papers. What kind of work do you do?
I do broad aspects of the immigration practice, you know, from people are filing for asylum, political asylum, et cetera, deportation defense and citizenship, basically anything that has to do with immigration, I do. And a lot of the people that come from Africa, specifically East Africa, are either coming as refugees or asylees, or they're having family members here petition for them. And that's majority of the work that I do.
Jason, we were just talking with TV anchor Monica Pearson, and she was saying one of the things that she enjoys, and I'm with her on this score, about the level of immigration here is that it's opened up the diversity of cuisine.
Yes.
What has it done for music since you're a DJ?
Well, it's interesting. It clearly, because there's such large immigrant communities, we are a lot of it's economically viable for promoters to bring artists here from, you know, all types of African and Caribbean artists to this city. Unfortunately, unlike Florida, D.C. or New York, we're still very segmented, you know. Interestingly, Ethiopians and Caribbean people have been working from day one. One of the longest-running successful Caribbean locations, well, shouldn't say Caribbean, international locations, was the historic Royal Peacock, by the way, where Ray Charles had performed when he started, and Gladys Knight and so on. Anyway, Ethiopian owner working with Caribbean promoters, and that used to be the place for everything, a mecca for everything from Sunday to Sunday for Ethiopian and Caribbean communities. However, it's still very segmented because if you speak to the average, even though the carnival draws hundreds of thousands of people to it each year, if you ask an average American who doesn't necessarily hang out with Caribbean people if they know there's a carnival here, they'll be like, what are you talking about? Which is crazy because the whole city locks down for it. Well, at least the downtown area locks down for it. So I'm not too sure where the connect is, the diversity is there, the variety is there, but the whole population is not necessarily embracing that diversity.
Yes, we've heard that from other folks. Ms. Ali, are you aware of or afraid of tensions with U.S.-born Americans, which sometimes flare up in tough economic times, and we're in those times?
Well, I'm not sure if it's tension exactly, but I think there needs to be more support for the newcomers, and the region has to be embracing them because, you know, the diversity makes America what it is, and the newcomers are sort of shunned, and with immigration policies tightening up, they really don't have a voice, and we are to blame too. The people that have been here longer need to be the connection point between the newcomers and the native-born, because the people that have been here for a long time have made their connections and are very well connected within the city or the country and are able to lobby their interests, and we just need to make sure the people that do not have a voice are heard. And in the end, it affects everyone, whether it's illegal immigrants or legal immigrants. A lot of the biases and prejudices will affect the legal immigrants as well.
Jason, do you see any generational differences with younger people perhaps mixing more, or is it across the board that people don't mix?
It depends on the situation. So a younger person who, I guess you're referring to the Caribbean person.
To right. Caribbean or to immigrants and right. immigrants and native-born you know, folks in Atlanta.
If it's a younger person that's directly from the Caribbean, there's a lot of things that they don't understand. When you especially if, say, you come from a predominantly dark race nation, you don't recognize, say, the things that, say, a person of African descent is going through in this country. You don't conceptualize that. And because you don't conceptualize that, there's a lot of misunderstanding, which leads to a separation, you know, and also a misinterpretation of cues, thinking that these cues mean something negative instead of it's coming out to something else. Now, the younger person, the younger Caribbean descent, well, immigrant descent person who's actually always either born here or maybe has been here a while, I mean, that person has overcome a lot of those things, and they actually do mix, you know, with the dominant group.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us here.
We were just speaking with Ms. Ali Ayele, an Atlanta-based immigration attorney originally from Ethiopia, and Jason Walker, a journalist and community activist. He's a native of Jamaica, and he joined me in the studios of our member station WCLK in Atlanta, Georgia. Time now to listen in on StoryCorps Griot. This initiative records the stories of African Americans all across the country. So far, StoryCorps Griot has collected nearly 2,000 conversations between friends and family, everyday people talking about their lives. Today, memories from a disc jockey in Memphis. In the late 1960s and early 70s, Herb Nealon spun records at WDIA, the first radio station in America programmed entirely by African Americans for African Americans. Recently, Nealon came to StoryCorps in Memphis with his sons, Martavius Jones and Herb Jr., to remember his days on the air.
Well, we weren't just playing music to entertain you. But, man, we were doing something for the community. Well, a mother called and said, "Little Johnny ain't got home his dog." I'd ask her, "What does he have on?" A white T-shirt and some blue jeans. I'd get right there on there. I said, "Look, Johnny's out there and his mama done called. I say he got on a white shirt, blue jeans. If you see him, take him home, because he's going to get it when he get home, but you better get him now." And people would do that. Man, it made everything that I was doing, those little things made it worthwhile. We knew we were doing something to change the community, and they knew we cared. And we could ask them for anything in the world. They would respond. As a matter of fact, when Dr. King was assassinated here, I was on the air. Mm. Oh, man, we had to be the voice of the community and urge them and beg them not to do nothing, no burning, no looting. And it was just, in a way, as Magnificent Montague in L.A. said, his slogan was, Bird, baby, bird. And I started to say that on there because I was disappointed. Mm-hmm. I was hurt. Tears in my eyes. But I thought about it. And I said, no. I said, the only thing that would cause more of us to get killed.
Mm-hmm.
Memphis didn't light a match.
One of the few major cities that didn't have anything.
None at all. And all over the country, you know, Chicago, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Man, it was devastation.
Well, now, what you got to do before we sign off, you got to do what you used to do when you went out there.
Oh, okay. I used to hear my show. Nature is the beauty of this earth. Love is the beauty of mankind. Whatever you do, we want you to do it good. If it's the Lord's will and the creek don't rise, I'll see you tomorrow at 3 on the other side. And remember, y'all help me, that I am your leader. Later on, black on, be free.
That was great.
Herb Neeland with his sons Martavius Jones and Herb Neeland Jr. in Memphis. You can record your GRIO interview at any StoryCorps booth across the country. All the GRIO Initiative recordings are archived at the Library of Congress. A copy of each interview will also go to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. You can hear more interviews at nprnewsandnotes.org.
Funding for StoryCorps GRIO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we bring you the second day of our coverage from Atlanta, plus a News and Notes First, a town hall broadcast in front of a live studio audience. Among other things, we'll take a look at how hip-hop generation voters could bring the heat in the 2008 election.